At this time, I would like to introduce our moderator, Dr. Owen Hughes. Dr. Hughes is the president of ION Corporation. He is an NIEHS Small Business Innovation Research grantee working with DNA microarrays for identification and characterization of environmental toxicity and a member of the NIH BST F50 Bioinformatics Review Panel. At ION, Dr. Hughes has been developing microarray infrastructures for the common environmental test organisms. He received a BS from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a PhD from the University of California, San Francisco, and an MBA from the MIT Sloan School of Management. At this time, I will turn the time over to Dr. Hughes. Dr. Hughes?
Thank you, Justin. Our first speaker today is Dr. David Dix. Dr. Dix is a research biologist and acting deputy director of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's National Center for Computational Toxicology at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, USA. Dr. Dix and colleagues are developing EPA's ToxCast research program utilizing high-throughput screening technologies to derive bioactivity profiles that can be used to predict characterize toxicity pathways, and prioritize environmental chemicals for further testing. Dr. Dix is an adjunct associate professor in the Department of Environmental Sciences and Engineering at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He earned his undergraduate degree in biological sciences from the University of Illinois at Chicago, a PhD in physiology from Rush University in Chicago, and completed a postdoctoral training at the U.S. NIH Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. He has published over 90 articles, reviews, and book chapters, serves on several editorial boards, and has given numerous national and international presentations on his research. Dr. Dix?
Thank you, Dr. Hughes, for that introduction. I've moved forward to the second slide in the PDF that I think we are all looking at this afternoon, and I'm very happy to be able to log in, call in, and make this presentation on ToxCast, screening and prioritization of environmental chemicals based on bioactivity profiling and predictions of toxicity. This is a research program initiated in the Office of Research and Development here at EPA in 2006, and over the last several years, we've really made some progress, and I'm excited to be able to share that some of that progress with you today. So let's move from the title slide two to the third slide in the set and just realize together that predicting toxicity will not be an easy task. This slide tries to represent some of the challenges, if you will. At the front end, as you move from the chemical exposure into the biological organism and cell, is the issue of metabolism and bioavailability, which is something that can be a real challenge to model in using in vitro or in silico methods. Secondly, there are a number of direct potential targets, chemical targets, for environmental chemicals. They can range from xenobiotic metabolizing enzymes of a different variety of sorts to other biological molecular targets associated with specific modes of action. And so in this diagram, we're representing modes of actions 2 and 3. You could also have somewhat indirect enhancer or suppressor effects on these different modes of action or biological or toxicity pathways. Moving from the direct chemical targets, you can also have moderating downstream indirect effects that ultimately lead to the in vivo toxicity endpoints that one might see. In this example, in this diagram, we've referenced rat liver lesions. And certainly with rat liver lesions, whether they be neoplastic or not, cancer or non-cancer, there's a multitude of different modes of action and associated toxicity or biological pathways leading to that particular type of endpoint. So these are some of the challenges to taking an in vitro predictive approach to toxicity screening. Let's move to the fourth slide, and I'll talk just a little bit more about these challenges for pathway profiling, profiling the bioactivity of environmental chemicals in biological or putative toxicity pathways. First, we have to identify the toxicity pathways themselves. I mentioned in the previous example rat liver lesions or hepatotoxicity. Well, there's also many other types of toxicities, ranging from chronic and cancer toxicity to reproductive and developmental toxicities. Developmental neurotoxicity is another example. The second challenge is obtaining the correct and appropriate and quantitative high-throughput screening assays, or HTS assays, for these various toxicity pathways and the biological targets within those pathways. And as I mentioned earlier, we need to have some ability to assess the role of biotransformation or metabolic capacity for these assay results and their relationship to in vivo toxicity. Third is the challenge of building good, comprehensive screening chemical libraries that cover a wide range of physical properties, physical chemical properties, as well as different classes of compounds, chemical classes and use classes. We've estimated in some publications over the last year or so that there's probably somewhere on the order of 9 or 10,000 environmental chemicals that are at some reasonable level of use, perhaps some reasonable potential for exposure, human exposure and environmental exposures, and that one could suggest as targets or candidates for a large screening chemical library. And fourth, finally, how are you going to interpret these in vitro results, these in vitro and in silico screening results, and how are you going to link those to in vivo effects, to frank toxicities? What's going to be the gold standard for this? And how are we going to compare the dosimetry in vitro to the dosimetry in vivo? So these are four major challenges that build into the, or that have to be surmounted in order to do a good job of in vitro screening and prioritization and profiling environmental chemicals activity across a wide range of biology and pathways. Moving on to the fifth slide, at EPA, we think that ToxCast, the ToxCast project, is part of the solution and can address some of these challenges successfully. This is a research program, as I've mentioned. It's centered in the National Center for Computational Toxicology. It addresses chemical screening and prioritization needs for a number of different EPA chemical programs, including pesticidal inerts, antimicrobials, drinking water candidate contaminant lists, high production volume and medium production volume industrial chemicals. It represents a very comprehensive use of high-throughput screening technologies. We're coordinating ToxCast with efforts going on at the National Toxicology Program and in the National Human Genome Research Institute, specifically the NIH Chemical Genomics Center, via a, what we call the TOX21 community or TOX21 collaborative partnership. And we're committed both in ToxCast and in TOX21 to stakeholder involvement and public release of the data. We have a couple of ways to help facilitate that. One is a monthly EPA teleconference. We call it the Chemical Prioritization Community of Practice. And if anyone on the call today is interested in that, I'd encourage you to email me and ask me to add you to that, or go to the NCCT website, the EPA NCCT website. One easy way to get there is Google. If you Google ToxCast, it'll take you to the ToxCast page, and you can back up from there to the NCCT homepage. And you can get a little more information about this community of practice, and if you'd like, email myself or anyone in the ComTox Center, and we'll get you added to that emailing announcement. Moving now to the sixth slide, and this introduces the 320 chemicals that are part of phase one of ToxCast. We call them the ToxCast 320. There are actually 309 unique chemical structures with some replicates sprinkled in, duplicates and triplicates for quality control purposes. 291 of these are conventional pesticide actives. Many of them are food use actives, and these were selected primarily because they have a wealth of in vivo toxicity data. There are also 9 industrial chemicals and 8 metabolites, which make up 12 parent metabolite pairs in this phase 1 chemical set. A few other points of interest: of the 320 chemicals, about 56 of them are in the proposed set of chemicals for the endocrine disruptor screening program. We represent about 53 of the 80 chemicals with guideline developmental neurotoxicity tests. 122 of these 309 are in the IRIS database as well. 14 of these are high production volume chemicals, and 11 of them were high production volume challenge chemicals. And you can look at the pie chart and the key associated with it and see that there's a fairly diverse set of chemical classes represented in the 320. Of course, the bulk of them are miscellaneous by this particular classification. But you can go through and classify this 320 in a number of different ways associated with their physical chemical properties. And it's a reasonably diverse set for the phase 1 of tox gas testing. Moving on to slide 7, another important piece to putting together the tox gas program is our in vivo toxicity database, ToxRefDB, Toxicity Reference Database. It's a relational phenotypic toxicity database that provides the in vivo anchoring data, or phenotypes, for ToxCast predictions. It includes 3 study types primarily, though there's some additional study types in there as well: the chronic and cancer 2-year bioassay data from both rat and mouse, rat multi-generational reproductive test data, and rat and rabbit prenatal developmental toxicity test data. There's 2 types of analyses that can be applied to the data in ToxRefDB. One is supervised, where we can look for common individual phenotypes, and the other unsupervised, where we can use machine-based methods and statistical methods for clustering phenotypic patterns. Moving on to slide 8, a little more information on ToxRefDB, the reference toxicity database. As far as the endpoints that are covered, from the chronic and cancer assays, the multi-gen reproductive, and the prenatal developmental assays, you can see on the left-hand part of the slide citations of 3 different papers that have been published this past year. Those are both actually Martin et al. 2009. One is in Environmental Health Perspective, one in Toxicological Sciences, and then Newson et al. Is in Reproductive Toxicology. And we started with what are called data evaluation records, which is a summary of all the treatment-related effects from guideline studies submitted to EPA by registrants for pesticide registration. And we started with these data evaluation records, or DERs, capturing all of the treatment-related effects, and from that into ToxRefDB, and from that we can define the lowest effect levels for various a wide range of different effects across the 6 different study types, counting the 2 species for both the chronic and the prenatal test. Moving on to, and you can see the number of chemical counts across these 6 different study types. We have over 300, approaching 400 in some of these studies. This is going, including other chemicals beyond what are in the phase 1 of ToxCast. Some of these will be phase 2 chemicals in ToxCast. You can see that for close to 200 chemicals, we have all 6 study types. Close to 250 chemicals, we have 5 of the 6 study types. So we have good coverage of the ToxCast phase 1 chemicals in ToxRefDB. Moving on to slide 9, shows some of the rat chronic bioassay results. These are clustered, which is basically a color-coded spreadsheet is one way to think of it. You have the effects on the various in vivo toxicity endpoints listed row by row, and the 320 chemicals listed by chemical by column across the top. And so the darker red indicates a more potent effect and a more and that there was an effect at all. And you can see several different groupings fall out. There's, on the far left, a fairly substantial number of chemicals. The dendrogram at the top is colored purple, that have a low incidence of any toxicity endpoints, except at the very bottom of this heat map. You see that almost continuous red line, almost to the bottom, almost at the bottom row. That's body weight effects. And we would expect to see body weight effects in essentially all of these studies because the guidelines require testing up to a maximum tolerated dose. But you can see some other interesting groupings of chemicals here. We've lost a little bit going to PDF and the animation, but we can still see the boxes that are marked with the arrows pointing to them, the thyroid and liver toxicants, a subset of the larger group of liver toxicants, a separate box for the kidney toxicants, and several other toxicity groupings and chemical groupings associated with those toxicity endpoints. This is a figure from the Martin et al. Paper in Environmental Health Perspectives. Moving on to slide 10, this shows all of the different effects captured from the in vivo toxicity testing of the phase 1 chemicals of ToxRefDB. Again, it's chemicals, in this case it's the chemicals as rows and the different effects as columns. And the ribbon across the top, the red, white, and blue ribbon across the top indicates whether it's a chronic cancer endpoint, a multi-generation reproductive endpoint, or a developmental endpoint. And you can see some sense of the breadth and depth of the data here. It is really kind of breathtaking almost to think that this represents about 30 years of regulatory toxicology testing and somewhere on the order of $2 billion worth of data. That now is going into the public domain through both the manuscripts and through the database itself. The database will be online on an EPA website, and you can query it directly later this calendar year. That was slide 10. Let's move on to slide 11 now and talk a little bit about the application of ToxRefDB in the ToxCast predictive modeling effort. The strengths of this particular database and data source is that we have thousands of guideline studies, so we have a large number of very uniform studies to draw from, a very large amount of value, dollars, and animal costs associated with these studies. They've been entered in ToxRefDB into a computable format, something that can be readily analyzed. These provide the anchoring phenotypes or in vivo toxicity endpoints for the ToxCast in HTS in vitro assays. It enables a comparison of endpoint incidence between species in cases where multiple species have been tested, as in the prenatal and the chronic cancer testing. And again, it's a searchable database that will be public later this year. You can go to the NCCT ToxRefDB page now, and there's some downloadable data files associated with the papers that have been published, other information on the database, and it will be this URL where we put a interface that one can directly query the database. There are some limitations associated with ToxRefDB and these particular data as well. The endpoints are somewhat aggregated in terms of independent features, and we are forced to aggregate even further in some cases to get a reasonable incidence rate or enough cases to have statistical power for predictive modeling. The data is largely qualitative. Lowest effect levels or low Ls associated with critical effects. We haven't uniformly captured the individual dose group incidence rate. So we know that there was a statistically and biologically significant treatment-related effect in a particular treatment group with a particular chemical relative to the negative vehicle control, but we don't know. We haven't captured uniformly that in the control, let's just say that 3 out of 50 animals exhibited the phenotype, and in the treatment group, 30 out of 50 exhibited the phenotype. And so that's what we mean in this bullet saying it's largely qualitative. Not all the ToxCast chemicals are represented in ToxRefDB. You saw some of that in the bar chart I showed you earlier. Not all the ToxRefDB chemicals are represented in ToxCast, so there's a two-way shortage of some missing data in that sense. There's species dimorphism that may link biology, may be linked to the biology, but it also could be linked to study design that has to be accounted for in analyzing some of these endpoints. And there's a very limited amount of mode of action data or mechanistic data available from these data sources, the data evaluation records, the regulatory studies that we're drawing from. Now, of course, we hope to introduce a lot of mechanistic data from the in vitro high-throughput screening assays. Let's move on to slide 12, which takes us to a little more detailed discussion of the high-throughput in screening assays that comprise ToxCast Phase 1. There's 467 different assays. There's actually over 500 different endpoints if one takes into account the multiple time points at which some of the assays are measured or accounted for. So there's a couple of different classes, two major classes of assays, the cell-free or biochemical assays, cover a really wide range of biology, different protein families, G-protein coupled receptors, nuclear receptors, kinases, phosphatases, you can read through that list. There's over 200 or plus of these different biochemical assays, and they represent a number of different assay formats, which we think is a technical strength to the program, including radioligand binding, enzyme activity, and coactivator recruitment assays as examples. In addition to the biochemical or cell-free assays, there's a large number of cellular assays, cell line-based assays in HepG2 cells, H549, HEC293, and others, in primary cells, both primarily human, but also some rodent primary cells, including rat primary hepatocytes, to complement some work done in human primary hepatocytes. And those are listed in the next bullet down, actually. I'm jumping ahead. The biotransformation competent cells, the primary hepatocytes, but a range of other primary human cells in some of the assays. And then a wide range of different assay formats and endpoints being measured. Cytotoxicity, reporter genes, gene expression, biomarker production and expression, and high-content imaging of a variety of cellular phenotypes. This represents the suite of assays, almost 500 assays that are making up Phase 1 testing in ToxCast. Moving on to slide 13, there's a number of what we can refer to as confidence builders. And what it represents are some expected results coming out of this first phase of ToxCast. One is relating to the estrogen receptor target. We see a number of chemicals that we know are estrogen agonists showing up, bisphenol A, methoxychlorine, its metabolite HPTE. For androgen receptor, we see a number of antagonist activity and binding activity. We see binding activity for estrogen receptor as well, vinclozolin, lonuron, polchloraz, other chemicals. A number of other targets, we see peroxisome proliferator activation receptor activity for perfluorinated chemicals, PFOA/PFOS, for phthalates, for lactoferrin, mitochondrial poisons, and cholinesterase inhibitors. Inhibition we also see for compounds that we know have these activities. So this is part of what's building some confidence in what we've seen in the Phase 1 data set. Also, there are multiple assays. Moving on to slide 14, another second type of confidence builder in the assays in the data set are that we have multiple assays and multiple technologies querying individual biological targets. So PPAR here is actually a number of different distinct receptors, PPAR alpha, gamma, and delta. But for each of these, we have multiple types of assays from different sources using different technologies. Querying the same or probing chemical biological interactions for the same target. You can see represented in this diagram at slide 14 multiple assays, these are the colored circles surrounding these different targets, LXR, a nuclear receptor, estrogen receptor, the CAR receptor, androgen receptor, etc. Each of these receptors have, I think there's a minimum of 5 distinct assays querying the chemical interaction, binding, activation, inhibition of these different nuclear receptors in this example on slide 14. This is building confidence in the data set because you have complementary data for the same or similar activities associated with the same target. Let's move on to slide 15. A third type of confidence builder coming out of the data set is that we can look within individual or across several different pathways analyze the results. So these are the PPAR, this is the PPAR signaling pathways. This represents PPAR alpha, PPAR gamma, PPAR delta dependent signaling. and we've color-coded in where we have different assays in ToxCast Phase 1, different assay types, the sources, technologies. The key is over on the left telling you whether it's a biologically multiplexed activity profiling. This is done, the biomap profiling is done in a combination of different human primary cells, transcription reporter assays, cell-based high-throughput screening assays from a couple of different sources, and high-content cell imaging assays. And you can then go and look at the targets in these different PPAR signaling pathways and see that we have, you know, the red assays for a variety of different targets, green assays, a wide range, pretty large number of blue assays in the transcription reporter assays, and some others sprinkled across. So we can look at chemical interactions across all of the PPAR signaling pathway or PPAR gamma or PPAR delta at multiple targets within those pathways and get a better sense of the activity of any one chemical or multiple classes of chemicals or all the different chemicals in any in these pathways, these biological pathways, putative toxicity pathways. Let's move on to slide 16. I'll show you a little bit of the data coming from some of these assays and also talk a little bit about this rather thorny issue of defining what a positive or what a hit is for any particular chemical assay combination. And then at some point you need to define a value, a quantitative value that one can use to represent that activity. In many cases we're using what we call generically AC50, it's the 50% activity concentration. It could be an inhibitory or an excitatory, antagonistic or agonistic activity. These are in particular results from Adagene, which is a transcription reporter assay. In the left-hand panel, you see the estrogen response element CIS assay results, and on the right panel, you see the complementary estrogen receptor alpha transactivation assay results. So on the far left, the most potent chemical, the black curve fit, is for the control estradiol in the ERE CIS assay, and again, estradiol in the ER alpha trans assay. You can see a nice hill slope, a nice fit to the hill slope curve. And then some representative results for some of the test chemicals. You can see in some cases, one of the more potent on the Adagene ERE CIS panel, one of the more potent results is that green partial agonist is one way to refer to that result. It's a dark green result for HPTE. So the most potent, in this assay, the most potent test chemical was HPTE, the methoxychlor metabolite, and that's to be expected. You can see, though, that it wasn't the most efficacious result. Methoxychlor is a little further along the potency scale, moving up, in concentrations up from, let's see, this is in micromolar, right, so in the, moving from nanomolar to micromolar range, you see the light blue curve from the toxichlor. It's less potent, but it's actually more efficacious in this assay than its HPTE metabolite. Okay, let's look over to the right panel. Again, we can see the green results, the Kelly green result for HPTE here. It's showing some initial activity, very, very low level though, at relatively this around the same range of potency. And then the methoxychlor curve, actually we're seeing good, a reasonably good curve at around the same potency as we saw in the ERE CIS assay, and a reasonable efficacy, though still only partial relative to the estradiol result. There's a number of other chemicals represented in these panels, but for the sake of time, I'll move on. I think this gives you some sense of how we went through, analyzed the data, in most cases relative to a positive control, in this case it's definitely relative to a positive control, fit it, in this case, to a hill slope, and determined an AC50 value for each of these compounds that showed that level of activity. Another set of results are on slide 17. These are from a company called NovaScreen. Actually, it's Caliper Life Sciences now. They've been bought. These are cell-free biochemical high-throughput screening assays for a number of different targets in the six different panels shown on slide 17. The top left panel is an inhibition assay for CYP, human CYP2C9 activity, and you can see a very nice concentration response for that particular compound. It's cyproconazole in this case, inhibiting human CYP2C9 activity. I think a lot of chemicals inhibited that particular CYP. Next to it, moving across, we see the human ER estrogen receptor alpha curve for HPTE, again, that methoxychloride metabolite, a nice concentration response. This is indicating binding of the human ER alpha assay. It's displacing the ligand, so it's competitive binding. So that's a nice complement to some of the activity values, cis and trans, we saw for this target, the estrogen receptor target from adagene. That's some of that complementarity across different assays for the same target using different technologies. So here it's a binding assay. These other assays are for different types of receptors, kinases, phosphatases, and again, you see concentration response data for particular chemicals or chemicals, either inhibiting or in some cases activating, in the case of the LINA kinase, an actual activation by the chemical. And we think this might be actually real and significant, something we're exploring further in follow-up studies. Moving on to slide 18, there's some example results from the quantitative high-throughput screening going on at the NCGC, the NIH Chemical Genomics Center, as part of our TOX21 collaborative. Here's results for two different nuclear receptors, the estrogen receptor alpha. In this case, it's being run in agonist mode. It's showing results for six different test chemicals. Positive control, I think, is in there as well. That might include, one of the six might be the positive control. And also results for PPAR gamma. In this case, these are both transactivation assays, so these are showing activity, agonist activity of the chemicals against these two different receptor targets. And in some cases, you can see some very nice, potent, and efficacious results relative to 100% activity, which is 100% of the positive control for these assays. Slide 19 shows results from adagene, the cis and trans assays, and staying again with some individual results for bisphenol A in the trans and cis assay, again getting a similar result in terms of potency and some relative efficacy, and HPTE, again, in the cis and trans format from adagene. On slide 20, some examples of results from CellsDirect, which ran a gene expression assay in primary human hepatocytes. So this is an assay that has some biotransformation capacity, being primary hepatocytes. And three of the different targets, there were 14 target genes assessed. One of these was CYP1A1, which is representative of activity, gene expression regulated by AHR, the AH receptor, aryl hydrocarbon receptor. HMG-CS2, which is a gene regulated by PPAR alpha receptor. CYP2B6, which is a CYP regulated by a number of different nuclear receptors, xenobiotic responsive nuclear receptors, but especially CAR, the constitutive androstenedione dione receptor. And let's see, you probably can see these results pretty well on your screens, and you can certainly blow them up a little bit if you need to. And in each of these, we may not have had a very good positive control for each of these, but I think in this case we did. I don't really want to go into the great level of detail. I'll just point out that you see a fair amount of activity. Let me point out two things. One is the top row are showing results at three different time points for the same chemical. And there was, in some cases, a very time-dependent response. At the bottom, we're just looking at results, I think, from just a single time point, but across a number of different chemicals. I think these results at the bottom are probably all 48-hour results. And you can see a range of different potencies and efficacies in the response. We found this assay to be potentially very valuable to us. This is, again, the primary human hepatocyte gene expression assay. So moving on to slide 21, this is a heat map again that captures the 624 different measurements across the different 467 assays. And it has the different assays across the different columns across the top. They're color-coded by the source and type of assay that is represented there. And then the 320 chemicals are along the different rows. And this is in a heat map showing the relative potency of the chemical effect of chemical activity associated with individual assays. It's in a paper that's been submitted now by Richard Judson and the rest of us, and we're hoping to have that out very soon. So 828 different assay chemical pairs, and this is out of tens of thousands, well, you'd say 624 times 320, whatever that is, had AC50s of less than 1 micromolar. So it's really a minority of chemical assay pairs that had nanomolar range AC50s. Most of them were in the micromolar range. Moving on to slide 22, we're going to now get into the analysis phase of some of the data from the HTS assays, and I need to watch my time a little bit here. One thing we're doing is focusing on mapping the individual HTS assays and their targets to genes and mapping those genes to pathways. So this is a mapping of the minimum number of human pathways represented in ToxCast phase 1. So across in the outer circle are assays that map to only one pathway. And these are all of the pathways represented in this particular case from K and Ingenuity. So the K pathways labeled K colon something are from K, and the I are from Ingenuity Pathways Analysis Software. And so these are all of the pathways from those two sources that are probed by targets, assays, in ToxCast phase 1. And this sets us up to then do a pathway-based analysis of biological or the activity of these environmental chemicals in the ToxCast. Moving on to slide 23, this shows you some distribution of the potency of the results for these different chemicals and assays, the hits, if you will, the function of AC50. If we weren't able to fit, either we didn't have enough concentration points or it was a type of assay that didn't lend itself to a fitting to a hill slope, if we didn't have an AC50 for a value, in some cases, we determined a lowest effective concentration, or an LEC. And you can see, if you look in the left-hand panel, if we look at on the left, there are genes. So these are assays collapsed to genes. So in some cases, there's multiple assays per gene. There was a fairly small number of genes that were perturbed at 1 micromolar or below. Only 9 chemicals have at least 20, well, let me get to that. So a very small number of hits for any assay or for any gene at below 1 micromolar. The largest number of hits, about 30 hits per chemical, were seen at 100 micromolar. And that's essentially the highest concentration tested. So there was a lot of low potency results for many of these genes and many of these pathways. If you look at the right-hand half of the left panel, if we move to the right panel on slide 23, you can see, again, a fairly low number of hits per assay, per chemical, below 1 micromolar, about 40-some hits or chemicals at 100 micromolar per assay on average. average as a mean, and then a similar result, it's just condensed for the direct assay. So in the bottom highlighted box, the yellow box here, it points out that only 9 chemicals had at least 20 hits or more with an AC50 of less than 30 micromolar. So there was a limited number of amount of activity across a limited number of targets or assays below 30 micromolar per chemical. So if you went above 30 micromolar, you'd start to see a lot of promiscuity of each chemical across a wider range of assays. If you restricted yourself just arbitrarily to 30 micromolar or below, you start to see quite a bit of specificity for each chemical and biological activity. Move on to slide 24. This is, again, a hit distribution, this time for chemical classes against those 33 minimal pathways I showed you a couple slides back. We required, in this particular analysis, at least 10 chemicals per class to be represented. And these are minimal pathways at a 30 micromolar threshold. And you can see for the conazoles, there was right around that mean of about 10 hits per conazole across these 33 pathways. And that was one of the more active categories of chemicals. Triazoles are a subclass of conazoles. That's true for them. Erythroids, some of these others were quite active. And you can, organothiol phosphates, and around 10 pathways being affected. And you start to see a dropping off as you move down from OPs to the pyridines, and then these very low activity three categories of chemicals down here at the bottom. So you see that some classes of chemicals have a wider range of biological activity across a wider range of pathways than other classes of chemicals. Moving on to slide 25, I mentioned conazoles at the top of the pathway count in the previous slide, and here's a explosion of that data across these different pathways that show any activity for any one of the 16 conazoles. You can see that for there's two pathways at the top there, one Ingenuity, one K, that were affected by all the conazoles. These included RXR function, and then metabolism with xenobiotics by CYPs, cytochrome P450s. And that would be expected because conazoles are actually designed to, they are an inhibitor of CYP51, which is an important fungal step in building the cell wall, synthesizing ergosterone. So some expected results for conazoles, and you can see some heterogeneity, perhaps some idea, sense of how we could start to think about using this analysis, this pathway-based analysis, to differentiate different conazoles within this chemical class and to associate pathway activity with specific in vivo toxicities, perhaps. So let's move on to trying just that in slide 26. We're going to focus on rat liver histopathology from the chronic bioassays. About half of the 248 chemicals where we had rat bioassay data showed no histopathology in the liver. And then there was a combination of proliferative lesions, pre-neoplastic lesions, or progression, if you will, and neoplastic lesions for the other half of the chemicals tested. And you can see the numbers associated with those different histopathologies. Moving on to slide 27, we're going to look at that subset of 21 chemicals that caused neoplastic lesions, the rat liver tumors, and you see that there were five genes that were strongly associated with, or correlated by a Fisher's exact test with the rat liver tumor endpoint. And you can see the activity indicated chemical by chemical in the green coloring. There were some chemicals that were rat liver tumor engines that weren't active in any of these five assays, indicating that there's something else at work, at least for those chemicals most likely, working through a different mechanism or mode of action. And then you can see that a number of the chemicals have activity in as many as 4 of the 5 assays. And if you look at the activity, the targets, it's PPARs, the HMGCS2 gene, which is regulated by PPAR, androgen receptor, which is known to be associated with RAF liver tumors, and then this chemokine, which is also thought to be associated with carcinogenicity and metastasis. This is actually an interesting result showing some biologically plausible associations between the in vitro assay results and RAF liver tumors. Slide 28 shows a gene network associated with the progression of RAF liver tumor endpoints. So the three purple balls in the middle is that progression of the histopathology from any lesion in the RAF liver to pre-neoplastic lesions to neoplastic lesions. Associated with each of those in vivo phenotypes are specific genes. So we've collapsed the individual assays to genes here. And so for any lesions, you have quite a few different assays, genes that are associated, statistically associated, and forming a gene network with that particular phenotype of histopathology in the liver. A subset of those and a smaller number are some unique ones that are associated with pre-neoplastic lesions, and an even smaller number, including the androgen receptor, PPAR gamma, PPAR alpha, HMGCS2, and CCL2, the same five I showed you in that previous, are associated with the neoplastic or the RAF liver tumors. The blue balls in this diagram are actually mapping the genes to pathways, and you can see the mapping of the endocrine pathways, AR and PPAR gamma result, the metabolic pathway mapping to many of the CYPs and these nuclear receptors regulating CYPs, and the cancer pathway associated with not only the PPAR alpha and gamma, but the CCL2 endpoints. So this is a representative, not a predictive signature, but a representative set of in vitro targets and a gene network represented by those in vitro assay results that can be associated statistically and biologically with the severity of RAF liver histopathology. Moving on to slide 29, this is closing up here and just mentioning some of the challenges that remain to be faced or are being faced. One, some of these I've mentioned earlier, getting the chemical library together. We're actually working on a very large chemical library for TOX-21 testing of about 8,000 environmental chemicals, and about 700 of those will be going into phase two of ToxCast. The quality control associated with that large number of chemicals is very important, making sure we have measured acceptable purity and stability standards being met. Defining the concentration response ranges that we should be assessing. Defining and calculating what is a hit. Is the definition of biological activity? Is it related to a minimum fold change in efficacy? Is it a fit to a hill slope, a hill function? To something else in terms of potency. Assay performance internally and across repeat runs with chemical replicates and making sure we're picking up other artifacts. But do we have sufficient coverage of the biological pathways, the putative toxicity pathways that are important to the potential adverse effects in human populations by environmental chemicals? Incorporating metabolic capacity or competency, biotransformation, if you will, and, you know, that can activate a compound or deactivate a compound. So we could under or over represent potential hazard of a compound in an in vitro assay relative to in vivo toxicity. And establishing target predictions in predictive toxicology based on pathway perturbations associated or predicting rodent bioassay data and following up with rodent mechanistic studies that confirm those results. But ultimately, really, we want to be predicting and associating these in vitro and in silico approaches with human effects, human hazards, and ultimately human risk. So with that, I've got two more slides. And I think, are we okay for time? Justin, can you come on the line, or Heather, and tell me, or Dr. Hughes, would you like me to stop now? I'm willing to. I've got two more slides here.
You could probably just go ahead and sum up the two slides real quick, and then if we have time left, we can take a couple burning questions, and then we will move on to Dr. Mattingly's presentation.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. So slide 30 tells us a little bit about the timeline of this work. I mentioned several times phase one, or the proof of concept of ToxCast, and that's been going on in the last couple of years, federal fiscal years 7 to 9. We're launching phase 2, which is a verification and extension of phase 1 of ToxCast, and we hope sometime in the future fiscal years 11, 12 or so, to reduce this to practice, to go into phase 3 of ToxCast, to be screening thousands of chemicals that are data poor in terms of in vivo toxicity information. But we can start to provide some information from these in vitro high-throughput screening assays that can be used to prioritize chemicals and perhaps predict toxicity. And this is complemented very nicely by what's going on in Tox21, where we have a more limited number of assays, but a much higher number of chemicals getting screened. And then final on slide 31 is some more details about phase 2 plans. Most of this I've already mentioned. You have the slides. You can read through those. We're working, as I said, closely with Tox21. We're looking to maximize chemical diversity in a couple of different ways in phase 2. We're evaluating the phase 1 assays for their value and adding some new assays as well. And then there's the issue of timing. When will we have the chemicals ready for phase 2? When will we be ready to launch the assays? And when will we have those results? And this slide shows you a couple projections for those three things. So that brings me to the end of my slides. And as Dr. Hughes just said, we may have time for a burning question or two.
Justin, our coordinator, has said that we're running a bit late, so we are going to take questions at the end of this. And so if we could leave the questions till then, leave your phones on mute, and we'll start in with Dr. Carolyn Mattingly. Dr. Mattingly received her BA in art history from Oberlin College. Following her liberal arts education, she attended Tulane University and received a PhD in molecular toxicology. As a graduate student, she investigated the effects of molecular the effects of the ubiquitous environmental contaminant 2378 tetrachlorodibenzo-p-dioxin, or TCDD, on vertebrate development using zebrafish as a model organism. She then pursued a postdoctoral training at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, where she investigated the effects of retinoids on differentiation in prostate epithelial cells and mechanisms by which environmental chemicals, including AHR ligands, interfered with retinoid signaling. Since 2001, she has been an investigator and director of bioinformatics at the Mount Desert Island Biological Laboratory, MDIBL, in Salisbury Cove, Maine. At MDIBL, Dr. Mattingly is involved in several collaborative research programs. First, she directs development of the publicly available Comparative Toxicogenomics Database, CTD, which aims to enhance understanding about the etiologies of environmentally influenced diseases. She also conducts a laboratory research program in which she is investigating the effects of low-level exposure to arsenic, or TCD, on vertebrate development using zebrafish. Recent studies have uncovered novel targets of these chemicals that make significant contributions to our understanding of the basis of consequent phenotypes. Dr. Mattingly?
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for inviting me. I'm going to give you sort of a broad overview of the Comparative Toxicogenomics Database, which we've been developing at MDIBL for the last 8 years or so. And we're on slide 32, just as a reference. And if you go to the next slide, the impetus for this project is really to help scientists explore the etiologies of environmental diseases. So at our institution, there's been a long-standing interest in toxicology and understanding mechanisms of chemical actions. And when I came to the lab 8 years ago, we were sort of charged with this idea of developing a database that was going to fill a certain niche that we felt wasn't being met, and that was a resource that would have data that would enable users to ask questions such as the ones that I show you here. And I hope I'll show you by the end of this presentation that the scope of the data that's in the database is actually quite broad, although I'll keep using arsenic as an example. You could imagine for any of the chemicals, genes, or diseases we talk about, you could substitute pretty much any gene, chemical, or disease of interest to you. So questions like what diseases are associated with arsenic affects which genes and proteins, which biological processes are affected by arsenic, molecular pathways are affected by arsenic, what other chemicals affect the same molecular pathways of your particular chemical of interest, and then what diseases are implicated with exposure to certain chemicals of interest. And I'm sort of glad I'm going second because Dr. Dix brought up some of the concepts that we'll be talking about in some of the data resources that they're using, that we are also using. So if you move to slide 34, so what we decided to do was there really was not a resource out there publicly where one could ask questions that crossed over these basic data sets, so chemicals, genes, and diseases. And if you click again, the approach that we took was to go into the literature and try to extract out the pieces of information that would allow us to make novel connections and also establish easy access to existing connections that have been made through the published literature between these entities. So what we did was take a manual curation approach, and what that means for us is to have PhD-level scientists who go into the literature, and we prioritize the literature based on chemicals for the most part, and we go into the literature and use control vocabularies to capture specific concepts. So you can see I'm on page or slide 35 that we capture chemical-gene interactions. We capture gene-disease relationships and chemical-disease relationships. And if you go to slide 36, you'll see that we do this with a number of controlled vocabularies so that curators, those who are capturing this data, are doing this in a very consistent fashion. And then what that translates to when these data are incorporated into a database is that as a user, you're also going to query these data using control vocabularies, and so you'll be able to consistently retrieve the information you're looking for. So for chemicals, we use a modified component of medical subject headings vocabulary that's been developed by the National Library of Medicine, so it's the chemicals and drugs component of that. For the diseases, we use the disease section of MeSH as well as the online Mendelian Inheritance of Man database, which curates genetic diseases, so gene associations with diseases. For genes, we capture our gene information using official nomenclature that's stored in NCBI's Entrée Gene database. And then in order to capture molecular interactions between chemicals and genes, we developed our own vocabulary, which we call an interaction vocabulary, and it comprises about 50 different terms that describe a variety of molecular interactions that are possible between chemicals and genes. And when I say genes from here on out, that also encompasses proteins. So these interactions can include things like chemical X increases transcription of gene Y. It may also include things like chemical X binds to protein Y. So there's quite a range of the types of interactions that can be captured. And so when we look at this triad, most of the concepts that are captured from the literature are actually binary relationships. So a chemical interacts with a gene. Well, that chemical may also interact with a disease. And so what we do by integrating these data is make connections between each of these edges that may not otherwise be apparent. So if a chemical interacts with a gene and that gene is known to interact or have some role in a disease etiology, we can create an inferred relationship then between that chemical and that disease. And I'll show you what that looks like in the database in a little bit. So if you go to slide 37, just to give you an idea of our curated data, where that stands, we have over 180,000 manually curated interactions between chemicals and genes and proteins. We have over 9,000 relationships between genes and diseases, and over 5,000 relationships between chemicals and diseases. And then I should add on top of this, so these are the core, these represent the core data that we manually curate, but we also integrate a lot of other external data sets, so things like KEG pathways that Dr. Dix mentioned. So those KEG pathways are associated with genes, they're associated with diseases. We also include gene ontology annotations. For those of you that are not familiar with that, that's an effort to essentially create an ontology that describes functions for proteins, and those are all incorporated and associated with genes in the database, and that adds value in the sense that if you're interested in genes that are associated with a particular chemical, you can also get an idea about what the overriding functions may be of those genes. So moving on to slide 38, I'm going to take you a little bit through the database and give you an idea of what the data looks like and how one might navigate. And it's a lot easier to do with animation, so you're going to have to bear with me with my little circles and things here. So this is slide 38 shows you the home page for our database, and you can see on the top navigation bar there's a home section, a search section, tools, and we'll go through some of this. So if you click on slide 39, you'll see that we're going to go to the search page, and if you advance again, you'll see what the search page looks like. And there are a number of options here. So anything that's showing up as blue or purple are obviously hyperlinks to other pages. And you can go to various advanced query forms, or up in the right-hand corner, you'll notice that there's this quick keyword search option, which appears on every page in the database. If you click to slide 41, I'm going to show you, if you did just a quick search for a term such as arsenicals or arsenic-containing compounds, and click on slide 42, you'll see what we call a chemical detail page. So for every chemical in the database, we provide a page like this, and you'll see the sub-navigation bar that describes basic information, interactions, genes, etc. Those comprise various curated and integrated data sets that are associated with this particular chemical, in this case arsenicals. You get a quick view of where the bulk of the interaction data in terms of chemical gene interactions lie with the graphs that's shown there. And if you click on slide 43, I'm just showing that we're going to move to what the interaction page would look like for arsenicals, and move to slide 44, you'll see an example of an interaction page. Now, I should mention, for those of you that are not familiar with the MeSH vocabularies, they're hierarchical, and we curate using these vocabularies. We also integrate them into the database, and what this means is when you're querying for a chemical or a disease, you can query using a very broad-based term, such as arsenicals, or you can query for a very specific term. When you query for a broad-based term, like arsenicals, you're presented with all of the children, essentially, of arsenicals, and you can see that represented here. So on the left-hand column, you'll see interacting chemicals. So these are the actual arsenic compounds that fall under the heading arsenicals. We show you a column called the interacting genes. So these are genes that we have curated interactions with sodium arsenite in this case, We tell you the organism in which our interaction has been curated, and this is cross-species. We include species from vertebrates and invertebrates. And then you'll see an interaction column in which the actual curated interaction appears. And our curators actually capture these concepts with essentially a shorthand that gets translated into the database. So in this top row, you'll see that sodium arsenite results in increased expression of A2M mRNA. So it's a very specific interaction, and they're captured consistently in terms of concepts. We always present the reference in which interactions or any data is curated, so the user can always go back to the original data if they have additional questions. So slide 44 is just pointing you to the gene tab where we're going to go next onto slide 46. And this is just another way of looking at the data. These are the same genes that you saw that you would have distilled from the interaction page that we were looking at previously. All of these pages, you can download the data and go do other things with. So in this case, we'll often take these gene lists and go do things like pathway analysis that Dr. Dix referred to earlier using Ingenuity Pathway Analysis. So we try to just give the user various ways of getting at the curated data. So slide 47, we're going to skip over this chem comp just for the moment and go to diseases. So if you're interested in diseases that are associated with arsenicals, page 48 shows you how we present these data. Again, arsenicals is a broad term, so you'll see in the left-hand column arsenates. Oops, sorry, I just skipped one. You'll see arsenates, and then in the next column you'll see diseases with which these individual chemicals are associated. Now, we capture two different types of disease relationships. We capture direct relationships, which are not represented here. So this would be if our curators go into the literature and they capture a known relationship between a chemical exposure and a disease, of which there are relatively few, actually, because it's so hard to make that assessment. And the bulk of our chemical disease associations are actually inferred. And if you click on to slide 49, I'll show you what that means. So in this example in row 2, arsenates are associated with Alzheimer's disease, and we infer this via HMOX1. So if you look in the shaded box, we have a curated relationship in our database between arsenates and HMOX1. We also know that HMOX1 is associated with Alzheimer's disease, and so we make an inferred relationship there. We always tell the user when this is an inferred relationship. We're not saying that this is true necessarily, but the idea is to make associations that may be the foundation of a novel hypothesis that could be explored experimentally. So on slide 50, I'm pointing you to the pathways tab, and on slide 51, show you an example of what this looks like. And now, again, these are KEG pathways that were mentioned earlier. We incorporate KEG pathways and associate them with genes. So in this case, we can make a connection between arsenic trioxide and acute myeloid leukemia pathway in KEG based on these 13 genes. Because we know that arsenic trioxide, we have curated molecular interactions with these 13 genes, and these 13 genes belong to the KEG pathway of acute myeloid leukemia. So the underlying goal of this is to say, we have all these data in the database for arsenicals. How do you start making sense of these things in terms of the genes that they're interacting with and the diseases that they may be interacting with, and providing a number of mechanisms by which you might start to get a broader picture of those relationships. On that sub-navigation bar, I'm not going to go through these pages, but we also have reference tabs for every chemical or every gene or disease in the database. So this would be all the references that have any arsenical database or any arsenical data in them. We also provide a link tab where we provide links to external resources that may have what we think would be useful additional information about arsenicals. So let's see, if we move to slide 52, this will take you back to that original search page that I showed you, and I just want to point out some of these other, we used the quick search option before, but there are other query pages that you can use from this page, and I'll show you an example of the chemical gene interaction query page on slide 53. So this is consistent with a gene query page as well, and it's really meant to just show you the potential complexity with which you can structure a query in the database. So in this example, if you're interested in the gene BCL2, so I can put in a specific gene, I can specify the type of curated interaction that I'm interested in and the degree. So I've selected expression, I selected increases and decreases. So what I want to know is the types of interactions that have been curated between arsenic and BCL2 with respect to transcription. And if you go to slide 54, you'll see what that page would look like. It's very similar to what the interaction page that we just looked at for arsenicals. Again, you'll see the arsenic compound, you'll see the interacting gene, and the reason that is coming up is because the formal name for that includes BCL2. So synonyms are searched for this as well. So the full name for BAD is BCL2 associated agonist of cell death. Again, this particular interaction is curated in mice, and the interaction is, you can see that in the interaction column, and again, the references are always provided. Just to give you an idea of how integrated the data are in CTD, I've circled BAD. All of these things, again, are hyperlinks, so you can toggle over to the equivalent gene pages as we were looking at for chemical pages. On slide 55, this is what a gene detail page would look like. So you're looking at the basic information. Again, you get the top chemicals with the most interactions that we've curated for this gene. And then, okay, on slide 56, now I'm going to show you, so you basically on this sub-navigation bar, a lot of those are going to look familiar to you based on looking at the arsenicals pages. I skipped over the tab that was called chem comps before. We have a gene comp here. And on page 57, I'll show you what that looks like. So the idea behind this was to, if you're interested in a particular chemical or a gene in a toxicological context, you might want to know other chemicals or genes that have similar toxicological profiles. And so we've created this a metric, which is sort of a modified Jacquard index, which compares, in this case, every gene to every gene in the database that has curated chemical interactions, and says which one of the chemicals are shared by both of these genes versus the total number of chemicals that they're each interacting with. And it gives us some similarity index. And on the right-hand column, we'll tell you actually what is the basis in terms of the number of interacting chemicals that are shared between, in the case of the top row here, BCL2-like-1 and BAD. So this is sort of a useful way of clustering genes that may have similar responses to chemicals, or on the flip side, chemicals that may have similar biological activities in terms of the genes and proteins that they interact with. So slide 58, we're going to shift over to, I just want to show you a couple real straightforward tools that we've added in the last year to try to help users navigate and distill some of the data in CTD. You can get to this page by the top navigation option called Tools. And this first option, batch query, this is in response to users who, so some of our users query one at a time, chemicals of interest. So they have a particular favorite chemical, that's what they always query. Other people have lists of genes or chemical groups that they're interested in, and so this is a way of allowing users to conduct that kind of query. So on page 59, I'll just show you what that looks like. You can select your input type, so you can submit a list of chemicals, genes, or diseases. You can enter your query terms in section 2. And in section 3, you can choose the type of curated or integrated data that we have in the database. So you might have a list of genes, and then you want to know all the curated interactions, maybe specific interactions. You could say, what are all of the chemicals that this list of proteins bind to, or associated gene ontology terms or disease relationships. And you can retrieve that data using a number of different formats, depending on what you want to do with the data afterwards. So page 60, we also developed just a real simple Venn viewer. So this allows users to compare associated data sets for up to 3 chemicals, diseases, or genes. And on page 61, again, I'll show you how you do that. You can select your input type, whether you're looking to input chemicals, diseases, or genes. You put in your particular terms. In this case, I've put in folic acid and arsenicals. And then you can choose the type of data that you want to be compared, whether they're curated interactions with genes, whether they're disease relationships, pathway associations. And if you move to slide 62, just as an example, so folic acid levels have been shown to have some effect on the susceptibility to arsenic toxicity, but it's not really clear what the basis of that is. And so if you were to look at manually curated interacting genes for each of these chemicals, you'd find that you have a subset of 118 genes and proteins that with which both of these chemical groups interact. And then similarly, if you were to create another Venn viewer, Venn diagram, selecting pathways associated with these chemicals, you'd see there's an overlapping data set of 21 pathways. And so this gives you some basis by which you could explore mechanisms that might help to explain what the interactions may be between folic acid and arsenicals. So the next page, going back to the tools page, finally my gene then, and this is our newest tool, which allows you to compare your gene list of interest to genes associated with chemicals or diseases in CPD. So on page 64, again, you can enter your gene list and then select data sets to compare. So I'm going to show you some data examples in a minute, in which you might have, in my case, we're conducting some microarray experiments in which we're looking at the effects of low levels of arsenic on gene expression during vertebrate development. And so we identified a list of genes that were significantly differentially regulated, and we were interested in whether or not we could validate some of these genes or make sense of this cluster of genes using curated data from CTD. And so in my case, I would have selected genes that interact with these chemicals and put in various arsenicals. So page 65, I'll show you what this looks like. So this is a zebrafish embryo. We exposed zebrafish embryos to 0, 10, or 100 parts per billion for 48 hours and identified a set of 99 genes that were significantly differentially regulated. And like all good microarray experiments, they're followed by ingenuity pathway analysis on page 66. To try to make some biological sense of what this cluster of genes may be. So we also compared those 99 genes to arsenic interacting genes in CTD, and you can see in that Venn diagram that there were 20 overlapping genes. And that was sort of interesting. I was actually expecting there to be more, but when we compared those 20 genes to to the genes that were found in this pathway that's shown in the bottom right-hand corner, which is the most significantly predicted pathway by Ingenuity analysis. On page 67, you can see that about 14 of those genes actually show up in this network, which seemed highly significant. And as it turns out, these genes in this network are associated with immune function. And this was quite gratifying because there have been other reports that have shown that developmental exposure to arsenic actually hampers immune response later in life, although there's never really been a molecular basis for that that has been proposed so far. So these genes identified by both microarray analysis in combination with CTD data give us a distilled view of genes that may help to explain some of these phenotypes. And these data were published in Environmental Health Perspectives this year. So the next slide on 68, this is another example of a group at NIEHS that we worked with, Chris Poirier's group, along with Ruben Thomas and Julia Golke. And what they did was they took a very large subset of CTD data, the chemical gene interactions, and combined that and did some statistical analysis with gene disease relationships from the genetic association database and tried to find clusters of chemicals that were had enriched relationships with diseases. And so this is a very small subset of a very large network that they generated in this paper that is cited at the bottom of the slide, and they found these sort of orange triangles represent chemicals, and a lot of these are retinoids or vitamin A derivatives, and they found that they were associated significantly with these balls, these purple balls, so type 2 diabetes, insulin sensitivity, so the circles are representing associated diseases, and the edges that connect the chemicals to these diseases are based on common underlying genes. So very similar to the type of inferences that we're making in CTD. So these chemicals are associated with genes. These genes are associated with these diseases. And with some statistical overlay, can we figure out whether there may be some real relationships there? And as it turns out, a number of these retinoid disease relationships are already documented in the literature and others are not. So it leaves room for developing novel hypotheses about conditions that may be associated with exposure to various retinoid compounds. Slide 69, just to give you another example of a type of project that has stemmed from the curated data that we have in CTD. So we're working with Mark Corrales, who's an investigator at the EPA, who's interested in the environmental effects on the etiology of autistic disorders. And in this case, we had a rather small data set associated with autism to start with, and the more we started talking to him, we thought, well, we'll go out and do a very focused curation effort on chemicals and genes and autism. And so I show you here that by the end of July, after a few weeks of curation, we now have actually over 213 genes with some sort of association with autism. And then what we did was take those 213 genes and go into CTD and say which chemicals have been associated with these genes. So there were over 2,000 chemicals. Obviously, that's a very large number of chemicals to go and look at in terms of experimentally. But what we're doing now is analyzing this set of chemicals by asking a number of different types of questions. So slide 70, looking at things like, how do we distill this list of 2,000 chemicals into some sensical cluster, essentially? So are there structural similarities between these chemicals? Are there regulatory features that might elevate some of these chemicals to the level of being more interesting? So, for instance, are any of these high production volume chemicals, in which case maybe they would have potentially more relevance or urgency in terms of being looked at? Are they associated with common functions or other diseases that have neurological phenotypes? So trying to really make sense of what those chemicals are and develop a subset of chemicals that may be worth looking into more closely in terms of their potential role in the etiology of autism. So slide 71, where are we going next? So we've, in this last year, started developing some really basic but I think very useful analysis tools to distill some of the data in CTD and adding visualization capabilities. So a lot of our data at this point is very text-based, and we've been exploring a number of tools such as Ingenuity Pathway Analysis, Cytoscape, to try to take these data now and turn them into more interactive visualizations so that the user can start to see patterns. So are there groups of genes that are associated with chemicals or groups of chemicals that have common biological effects? We're also looking at the integration of a number of additional data sets, so things like single nucleotide polymorphisms in genes that are known to have some sort of disease association. And then finally, I just mentioned that we're also working on some text mining projects, and we will hopefully have a paper out shortly that will discuss some of our progress in that realm. And for those of you that are familiar with text mining, it's obviously very error-prone when used all by itself, but in combination with manual curation and a workflow that we have well-established for CTD, there's some real potential for increasing the efficiency of data for manually curated databases. The bottleneck is most often the manual curation part, because if you really want that data captured correctly by scientists who understand the information, it takes time. So there are ways of trying to enhance that process with some computational assistance. I don't know if I told you to advance previously, so I'm on slide 72 now. And I'm just showing here a few references that are publications that we've had in the last year, and the purpose of this is really just to, in these first two examples, for those of you that are interested in CTD, there's some more detail about some of the studies that I presented with the NIEHS group, as well as the zebrafish work, in terms of how CTD data might be leveraged for specific experimental questions. And then the latter references really are more informational about, in terms of providing more details about the type of data that's integrated into CTD, what the curation process really involves in terms of its nitty-gritty. And then I also provide a reference to a review that we put together this year on chemical databases in general, and I can tell you that it's already outdated, having heard Dr. Dix's presentation. But I encourage you to take a look at these, and we're very much open to feedback from the community. We've had several community-requested curation initiatives in addition to the autism project that I described for you already. And so if there are particular chemicals or diseases or genes of interest to anybody in the community, we really encourage you to let us know, and we can certainly put those requests into our priority pipeline. And I'll just finish on slide 73 and acknowledge the three scientific curators who are working on this project. We have three software engineers and a system administrator. James Boyer is at Yale. He functions as an advisor to us. And Tom Hampton is a statistician at Dartmouth who has been very, very helpful to us in terms of helping us with our gene and chemical comps, as well as some future projects that we're working on. And the zebrafish work that I presented was done in collaboration with Tony Planchart, who's an investigator here at the lab. And this project, again, is funded by NIEHS as well as NCRR. And please stay in touch with us and let us know if there's something, if you have feedback for us or if there's something we can do to help you with your various projects.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mattingly. Before we open the questions and answers session to the presenters, I want to make sure everyone is aware of the links page on the and the online feedback form. On the links page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place the seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look forward to your comments as we will continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Links to the additional resources page and feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation. I will now open the question and answer session to for all presenters and participants. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute, state your name and organization, and ask your question. I'll read online questions, but I'd like to let's go to the phone line first. So again, if you would like to ask questions, please take your phone off mute, state your name, organization, and ask your question.
Hi, this is John Christopher in Sacramento with California EPA.
Hello, John?
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question of the first presenter regarding slide number 30. In slide number 30, you were going to try and make some predictions about chemical classes. I wonder what kind of help the pharmaceutical industry might be if they were to add the power they have with the information that they've got from the simultaneous or the sequential testing of the same chemicals in both animals and humans.
Dr. Dick?
Yes, thank you for that question. Slide 30. So this is in the, what part of the, John, what part of the slide 30 were you referring to?
Let me have the other person handling the slides here get back to slide 30. It was toward the bottom of the slide where you were trying to make predictions.
Okay.
Yes, when you were going to reduce things to practice. What I was worried about was making predictions that would work beautifully for mice or for rats or perhaps for primates, but might not be applicable to humans.
Right, right. So if you look up at the table above that part of the figure on slide 30, if you look at row, the phase 2B, and what that indicates, it refers to them as known human toxicants. And what those are, in fact, are failed pharmaceuticals. And what we've done is we've managed to work out some agreements with a number of different pharmaceutical companies, first and foremost Pfizer. And they're providing us, they have provided us over 100 failed pharmaceutical compounds that have gone through preclinical and, in most of those cases, into clinical testing and, you know, stopped at some, either phase one or phase two of clinical testing for safety issues primarily. And so really it addresses exactly what you just suggested, which is a really good idea and one we actually were able to act on and make some headway on in the last year or two. So in phase two, we'll be doing this testing of these pharmaceutical agents, these failed pharmaceuticals, and we'll be able to, at least in some cases, have a direct verification of extrapolating across the species and, you know, translating any kind of predictive signature or predictive ability for in vivo toxicity in animals to correlative toxicity in humans.
How would they ask? Hi, this is Deborah Taylor. I just wanted a clarification.
Organization?
Oh, I'm with DTSC in Sacramento. I'm in the veterinary world, and there's always the kind of fine points of in vitro versus in vivo testing. And for me, in vivo also includes tissue culture and cell culture. So could you address that? How are you using those terms?
Yeah, I assume you were addressing the question to me again?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah, this is David Dix again from USETA.
Yeah, and it was basically on, I guess, slide 29 or 28.
So you would refer to cell culture assays as in vivo?
Because you talk about you talked about the difficulty or the potential for metabolism changing your endpoints from an in vitro situation, which for me is a test tube, versus an in vivo situation, which is live animal, but also for me could include tissue culture because you also have metabolism happening.
Usually some portion or some subset, it's usually compromised in some fashion depending on the particulars of the cell or tissue culture we're talking about, the cell types, et cetera.
But people have shown direct correlations with some in vivo systems, well, I guess what you call in vitro cell culture systems or tissue explant systems with live animals. And so for me there's a little gray area there, and I just wanted to clarify how you're using it in this particular.
So one way to think about it is we have assays with a range of metabolic capacity, from biochemical assays with little to no metabolic capacity, though I suppose you could argue a SIP assay has metabolic capacity, and anyway, then we're starting to nitpick, but to cell-based assays for transformed cell lines with very limited metabolic capacity to the primary hepatocyte cultures, which probably have about as much metabolic capacity as you're going to get in vitro or outside of an intact organism. I didn't mention it in any great length. We also have some alternative species assays that have been run in primarily zebrafish and then a little bit with C. elegans. But the issue of metabolism or bowel transformation is a particularly thorny one. It's something that we're addressing both through our endpoint assays, if you will, our high-throughput screening assays, but also through some in vitro metabolism assays, including a hepatic clearance assay using human hepatocytes, a mixture of human hepatocytes. So we'll have some assessment of the intrinsic clearance, the metabolic conversion or biotransformation of all the chemicals going through ToxCast. We'll use that for some in vitro toxicokinetics, as well as factor that into sort of the metabolic capacity or the potential, metabolic potential of the compounds. There's also some in silico tools that'll help us there, but we're working out conceptually how we're going to test and apply any information we can gather on biotransformation. And to some degree, it's going to initially be nothing more than a flag indicating that any in vitro result needs to be weighted accordingly because this particular chemical or class of chemicals has a high potential for biotransformation. And biotransformation, as I mentioned, can go two different ways. You could activate or deactivate, and you could under or over represent potential hazard.
I only brought the question up is because you have a mixed audience. I mean, a lot of my coworkers are toxicologists, and their definition of in vitro is often a little different than mine as I come up in the veterinary world. So.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, so in toxicology, we would routinely refer to it as a cell-based system as an in vitro system.
Additional questions? I guess this is Owen Hughes, the moderator. I guess another aspect of that same issue is basically structure-based endpoints versus readouts of binding or expression, and that all gets convoluted when we go into high-content imaging assays. Dr. Itz, why were so many of the 320 pesticides versus other types of chemicals?
A couple of reasons. First and foremost, because food use pesticides in particular have a lot of in vivo testing data associated with them. You know, it's the requirement for registration with US EPA. Secondly, we were able to pick across food use pesticides and pesticide actives in a way that gave us reasonable representation across chemical space and also reasonable representation across some of the target chemical programs that are in need of prioritization within EPA. So we do have some inerts, we do have some antimicrobials, we do have some high and medium production volume industrial chemicals, and these are the compounds that we now, you know, you're now getting into classes of compounds with limited in vivo testing data and a real need for screening and prioritization. You know, environment, if we started with working with a bunch of pharmaceuticals, what you'll, I think the biology is going to be very different.
Are you going to be receiving the toxicology data from the pharmaceutical sales as well as
the ones I referred to earlier?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, we'll get both the preclinical and clinical data.
Fantastic.
But, you know, there's a, if nothing else, there's a frame shift, orders of magnitude frame shift in potency of compounds, if not other really important aspects of their biological activity between, you know, many pharmaceutical compounds that have been designed to interact with a specific target and an environmental chemical that's probably not been designed to have any specific biological activity. And yet, you know, environmental toxicology has been, because of guidelines and for reasons of, you know, safety testing, been tested at very high concentrations. And so it's a very different world than folks at the Food and Drug Administration and folks in the pharmaceutical industry are used to dealing with.
Dr. Mattingly, a question from online from Kimberly Salinas, the U.S. EPA GED. She asks, is the CTD database limited to mammalian species, or are other wildlife species included as well?
No, actually, we curate chemical gene interactions in all vertebrates and invertebrates. So we don't include things like bacteria, but certainly there are other wildlife organisms included beyond mammalian. The majority of the data, however, just based on how toxicology studies are usually done, fall into you know, mouse and rat. But there are certainly a lot of fish species and things like that. In terms of phenotypic endpoints, right now we're focusing on human diseases, but one of the potential future projects would also be to start curating phenotypes that may be more relevant to, as she suggests, wildlife organisms. But that is not yet happening.
Very good. Another question from online, Dr. Dick. Anita Myers from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers asked, you to please further define what is meant by toxicity pathways on slide 22. Items are listed and referred to as pathways. However, several of them seem to be single components or events that lead to toxicity.
Okay. 22. Yeah, so in each case, if it's marked with a K, it's a K, what's referred to as a, you know, K pathway, the Kyoto Encyclopedia of something, something, K-E-G-G. And if it's marked with an I, it's from Ingenuity Pathways Analysis. It's true that there is a mixture, so I'm looking through like the KEG, One of them is neurodegenerative diseases. So this is a pathway, a biological pathway, or perhaps you could think maybe even a network or combination of pathways leading to associated with neurodegenerative disease. In other cases, they're more specific, like MAP kinase signaling pathway right below it. This is just some of the variability within the definition of pathways associated with KEG. There are different categories. I don't remember off the top of my head how, you know, KEG's collection of pathways are structured. In Ingenuity, I think most of these that I see are more, I think, typical of what you would call a biological pathway, not necessarily a disease pathway. Whereas KEG, it looks like there really is a mixture. There's an Ingenuity Huntington's disease signaling. So in some cases, there are pathways associated and targets within those pathways associated with the disease process, and then other, it's a metabolic or other biological pathway. That's just, what's out there, and I think they're both valuable types of mapping of assays, genes, targets.
Great. Any other questions from phone lines? I'm not sure who this question was addressed to, probably both. David Powell of the EPA, Washington, D.C., asks, how are you using these databases to investigate potential interactions between chemicals? For example, if chemical A is linked to gene 1, chemical B is linked to gene 2, and a disease is strongly linked to pathways that involve both genes, to a pathway which involves both gene 1 and gene 2, would your query system be useful for flagging this? Perhaps Dr. Mattingly?
One of the things that we think our chem comp and gene comp metric will help with is doing things like this, and we have a number of other tools that are in the works that basically we'll do what is suggested here, so starting enabling users to start to see patterns. So which groups of chemicals may be interacting with individual genes that may have common overlaps to diseases, as I think if I got the example right. What's that? So basically we have all of this very detailed data and taking more of a high-level view where you could see overlaps in patterns for disease associations or chemical gene interactions. So the answer would be yes, that could help you do that.
Okay. I seem to be having trouble updating my online questions. I'm not sure if we have more online questions.
Hi, this is Jay Dahl from US EPA Cincinnati. Could I have a question?
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm wondering, this is a question to Dr. Dix, and I'm wondering for the TOXREF database, the three type of studies captured in this database include a chronic study, random multi generation, and also the developmental study. For the chronic study, in addition to the cancer endpoint, have you also captured other organ-specific information, like liver toxicity, no L, low L, or kidney toxicity, low L, no L?
Yeah. Hi. This is David Dix again. I'm sorry, you're with what part of the agency?
This is AXIA in Cincinnati.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, we've attempted to capture all treatment-related effects. Now, we're dependent on the data summaries from the data evaluation records, so it's conceivable that there are treatment-related effects that were not in those reports, but that would be, not the intention of the report. It would be a failure on its part, and then some subsequent failure on our part. So we have tried to capture all treatment-related effects, cancer and non-cancer, from any study type. and not just critical effects associated with the establishing the no effect or the lowest effect, lowest observed adverse effect levels, but all treatment-related effects.
So those effects is not only quantitative. You also captured quantitative, like no L, low L.
It's quantitative in terms of potency. What it's not quantitative in is terms of the incidence or efficacy, if you want to think of it that way. So we're starting to capture some of this data, but we didn't typically capture. We'd capture that you saw, let's just say, liver adenoma at 50 mg per kg per day. But we didn't capture that in the 50 mg per kg day dose group, we saw an incidence of 6 out of 30 relative to 1 out of 30 in the vehicle control.
Okay. How about a non-carcinogenic effect?
Yes. Yes. All effects.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
All tissues, all types of effects. You know, there's on the chronic cancer, there's, you know, not only histopathology, there's clinical chemistry, there's general observations. Yeah, any and all treatment-related effects.
Great. Dr. Dix, we have a question for you from Jed Goldstone of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Is there a database of molecular models available for the ToxCast 320 database, data set?
That's coming. We're probably going to put it into a package we're calling ToxMiner that we'll be publishing on hopefully this calendar year and making freely available. So it'll be an executable that people could install on their desktop. It would have all of the underlying data in an associated database, and also we're working to make it where it would routinely or on demand or on request update itself from online accessible data files from ToxCast. So right now that's not the case externally. Internally, intramurally here at EPA, we have a ToxMiner sort of in some form up and running in a collection of these different models. And through our collaboration and the ToxCast associated with the May meeting, the ToxCast Data Analysis Summit, we have about 30 different groups international, across the world working with us, looking at the data, doing predictive modeling and other applications for prioritization.
Dr. Dix, do you see a correlation of the lowest effect concentration to the physiological assays?
Owen, could you clarify what you mean by physiological?
Sorry, the lowest lowest effect concentrations in the gene expression assays or the binding assays to the more physiological assays such as mortality or weight loss.
Yeah. So all of the gene expression assays that we have as part of ToxCast are run in vitro.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have the ability to estimate a human oral equivalent to that. It's a work in progress. We've completed the assays and analyses for about 40 of the 320 chemicals, so that's something that's ongoing. We don't have the data from rat primary hepatocytes to do something similar for rat, which would then allow us, you know, so we call this a reverse dosimetry or reverse toxicokinetics approach. So that would allow us to then make a direct comparison of the effective concentration in vitro to the effective dose in vivo, which if I understand the question is what was being asked. So that's, I think we have a limited capability in this in vitro to in vivo dose response comparisons at this point in time.
A question from online for both speakers, from Jimmy Spiro at Cal EPA. He's asked Looking at chemical interactions may be really important. I'm wondering if you will include toxicogenomic responses to multiple chemical exposures versus the more common single chemical exposures. Either Dr. Dix or Mattingly.
Yeah, I mean, what we curate is based on the literature. So if there is a multiple chemical assay that's been done, we will capture it. And there are many examples of that in there. Unfortunately, most people don't do multiple chemical studies, so there's sort of a limiting factor there. But one of the things I think we can predict or think about in terms of the integrated data sets in CPD are looking at individual profiles of gene interactions of chemicals and determine whether that can be useful in terms of predicting overlap. So, for instance, in that folic acid and arsenicals example, you can start to see, based on what's known, is there overlap between the biological effects in terms of their molecular targets of different chemicals, and then which targets are unique to each of those chemicals.
Dr. Dix, is the ToxCast program looking at combined exposures?
At present, I don't think we're going to have in phase one. We don't in phase one, and I don't think we'll have combined exposures or combined studies in phase two. In the Tox21 program, where we have more substances and chemicals being tested, we have done some initial studies with some mixtures, particularly some mixtures of triazoles or conazoles, some mixtures of pyrethroids, some mixtures of carbamates and some OPs, but really on a very limited basis at this point in time. I expect that to go forward, though, at least in the Tox21 testing initially and eventually in ToxCast. I would like to see that. It's just, you know, when there's 7, 8, 9,000 individual chemicals and something on the order of two-thirds of those have little to no testing data, we probably need to start individually, at least in most cases, before we start screening mixtures.
Well, are there any more phone line questions?
Yes, I'd like to ask one more. This is John Christopher in Sacramento. This question is for Dr. Dix. I happen to be a risk assessor, and in quantitative risk assessment, we're almost completely confined to dose response curves. As you talked about hits and biological effects and concentrations and doses, it did not seem clear to me that there was a unified concept of dose and response that could be useful for quantitative risk assessment. How far have you gotten down that road?
Thank you for that question, John, because I think it frames up a very important issue. I think it's important to realize the limitations of this in vitro screening approach. I think it's appropriate at this stage to apply it to prioritization of chemicals, ranking chemicals relative to each other, relative from class to class, further based on their biological activity against individual molecular targets or biological pathways that could be significant to a toxicological mode of action. The translation from in vitro concentration response to in vivo dose response, which would be necessary for an application to risk assessment, is going to involve and require some additional tools, some additional data, and some additional time and resources. So I think it's important that we don't prematurely try and take an in vitro result, a hit, an AC50, an AC20, any value off of a concentration response curve in vitro, and blindly and without careful thinking, apply it to any kind of a risk assessment. A good example where this might be tempting is when the target, an assay, is interrogating the potential endocrine activity, which is a very important topic in toxicology and in public health. Just because a compound has an in vitro estrogenicity or anti-androgenicity does not immediately and has an in vitro quantitative value associated with that does not mean that that in vitro result is ready for application in a risk assessment. And that's not only, I think, consonant with agency policy, that's my scientific opinion.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Well, I think we're a little over time, and I'd very much like to thank our presenters, Dr. David Dix and Carolyn Mattingly, as well as the organizers, Justin Crane and Heather Henry, and thank all of the participants for participating in this presentation.
Bye-bye.